I call our second case for the day, I have a couple of things to go over with you all. The first is that we have some students here on our program of Court with Class, which is a combined program between the court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. They are from Oshkosh Valley Correctional School.
Correctional School.
No.
No, no, no. No.
Jack needs to put her glasses on.
I'm not 18-point type. I have problems. Okay, let's try it again.
Oshkosh
Valley Christian School. How about that? Is that better? Okay, super. Would you all please stand? Now you really remember your visit to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Well, thank you very much for coming. We really enjoy having the students come today. You may be seated. After we are done with this argument, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley will come out and speak with you a little bit. Now, we've met you, but I'd like you to be introduced to all of the justices this morning. And beginning on my far right is Justice Michael Gableman. Next to Justice Gableman is Justice David Prosser. Next to me is Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I'm Justice Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left is Justice Annette Ziegler. And on the far left is our addition, newest justice just today, Justice Rebecca Bradley. So with that lineup, I'm just about to call the case. I know some of you were here last go-round, so you may have heard me say this before, but I didn't see everyone that's at council table in the audience. Students, so that you know, we have lights that tell council when they should go and when they should stop. And we give each side 30 minutes, so we treat them both the same way. When the green light goes on, council may begin. When the yellow light comes on, council knows he or she has about 5 minutes to go before his time to present the case to us is concluded. When the red light comes on, council is to stop unless he or she is in the middle of answering a question that has been posed by a justice. Council are very good. They adhere to the red lights really quite well. Unfortunately, we don't always behave quite so well. And
well, I don't think the record should reflect we're confessing error on not behaving well.
Yeah. So thank you, Justice
with
Bradley.
That clarification, you can proceed.
Okay. What I was trying to say is that we will try to adhere to the red light as well. There have been times when we've given one side as much as 15 minutes more than the other side, and that may appear either to counsel or to someone watching our proceeding as though we either favor one side or we're not treating both sides fairly. So we're going to try very hard to adhere to the red light. And with all of that now out of the way, I'll call our second case for the day, State versus Lynch, case number 11-AP-2680. Counsel, are you ready to go?
I am, Your Honor.
Please begin.
May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Moeller, representing the petitioner, State of Wisconsin. This matter is here on the State's petition to review a decision of the Court of Appeals for District 4, which affirmed an order of the Dodge County Circuit Court prohibiting the complainant in this case, A.M., from testifying against Patrick Lynch at his trial for three counts of sexually assaulting A.M. when she was a young child and one count of stalking A.M. when she was a young adult. Before this court are three questions. Should this court overrule State versus Shifra, a court of appeals decision, and the Shifra line of cases, because Shifra was wrongly decided insofar as it relied on Pennsylvania versus Ritchie for its due process analysis and reached a result that is actually contrary to U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence. Second, assuming this court declines to overrule Shifra's due process analysis, should this court nevertheless reject Shifra's remedy of automatic witness preclusion every time a defendant satisfies the preliminary showing of materiality required under SHFRA and State versus Green, but the privilege holder, in this case AM, refuses to waive her privilege under Section 90504 to enable the Circuit Court to conduct an in-camera review of her privately held privileged records. And thirdly, again assuming that there is no overruling of SHFRA's due process analysis, should this court hold that even if the privilege holder does not consent to in-camera review, this court can use Section 146.822A4 to obtain those records without the privilege holder's consent to conduct the in-camera review that SHFRA and its line of cases mandates. The state's arguments for why we believe SHFRA was wrong from its inception are set forth in detail in both of the state's briefs in this case. They were also set forth in the state's briefs in State versus Johnson. And rather than simply repeat those arguments, what I would like to do is to address the three reasons counsel for Lynch has given for why this court should decline the state's request to overrule SHFRA.
Before you do that, counsel, if we should reject SHFRA, what would be the rule of law that replaces SHFRA in this case?
I think the rule would simply be that when you go to trial, that is when the right to confront adverse witnesses kicks in. And depending on what questions are being asked of the person who holds the privilege, a court can rule that specific questions either do have to be answered or don't have to be answered. But the rule would not have any kind of pretrial discovery involved. In other words, if there is no due process right to obtain pretrial discovery, including a pretrial and camera review of records, this would really be more a matter of confrontation on the Sixth Amendment as opposed to a due process analysis.
Well, not only confrontation, but the Sixth Amendment says they have a right to, defendant has a right to call witnesses in defendant's behalf, right?
That's correct.
And isn't that involved in this case?
That could be involved. If we jettisoned SHFRA, then I'm assuming, and especially if this court were to adopt the state's argument, they could obtain records by subpoenaing various counselors or custodians of records. And I don't do trial work, but I assume that what would happen in some of those cases is that the custodian of the records would move to quash the individual subpoenas. But the difference is there the defense is really limited to relying on information that the defense already has in its possession, not information that it has obtained by giving a witness, in this case the alleged victim, the very difficult choice of saying, you can either waive your privilege.
I have to interrupt you. I don't understand that. I understood from your brief that this was a timing issue for the state, whether it's pretrial under what you call discovery, or you're going to push it to the trial where it's going to be a matter of quashing on the basis of the privilege.
I don't believe that we've ever taken the view that you're pushing it off to the trial. As a practical matter, the confrontation issues will arise, but I think it's a very different kind of analysis. I don't think it's a matter of the state saying, you can't get this stuff before trial. You can only get it at trial.
Well, so we're at now, we're just ready to go to trial, and you have pretrial motions at that time because you want to get them out of the way, right? That's standard operating procedure.
Correct.
At trials, all right? So the defendant is going to call the custodian of mental health records, whether there is a state custodian or a private mental facility. What, hospital or doctor's office, okay? So now the witness is called. What happens? Defendant is using their right to compel witnesses, okay?
You're asking if the witness is called at a pretrial hearing or at the trial itself?
Look, we're at trial, but before the trial begins or after it begins, the court considers motions that will arise at trial and gets them out of the way.
Correct.
Rather than take the time when the jury is there, right? Okay, and one of those that will come up is the defendant has subpoenaed a witness, and that witness has been asked to bring records, and it all relates to the medical records of the complainant, right? Okay, so lay it out for me.
In that situation, we would still say that the records should not be open for dissemination either to the judge or to defense counsel. There will be certain questions that a defendant can ask a victim, an alleged victim, about her mental health history.
I'm not up to asking the witness, now, the victim. I'm asking the custodian. I'm asking the
I think the question in those cases sometimes will be a question of waiver. For example, are some of the records that you're bringing with you, has she or he, the victim, already disclosed those records?
Right, they haven't.
Okay, if they haven't.
If the records, it's all secret and the victim is going to exercise her privilege and say to whoever the witness is going to be, I got a privilege. What I'm trying to see is you're just moving it from one part of the trial or pretrial to the next, and you get the same questions. That is, the same issues that we have now under Schiffer. You're just pushing them forward. That's my point. And so far, you haven't shown me why I'm wrong.
Well, I respectfully disagree that you're just pushing it down the line, because the state's position in the first instance is fairly absolutist in the sense that you don't get to look at those privileged records as the trial judge or as the defense attorney. It wouldn't be any different than if a defendant were saying, I want to get to records that are covered by the attorney-client privilege because I'm a co-defendant and I know that my accomplice went to see a lawyer after charges were filed, and I can make a showing that what he told that lawyer would really help me in my defense. And so I want to see any notes that that original defense attorney might have taken in interviewing my co-defendant. That's one example. Another example.
Don't worry, man. I want to know what's the state's position. Isn't the state's position absolutist that that there's no in-camera review by the court and no review by a defendant?
Yeah.
I think your absolutist position is true with Schiffer, and it's true here if you moved it to the trial.
And our point is that there are some privileges that the defense doesn't have the right to penetrate, and that if you allow the privilege to be penetrated when you're talking about medical records, psychiatric records, why wouldn't the same analysis apply if you're talking about records that are privileged by the attorney-client privilege or even the privilege for what used to be called priest-penitent, and I think it's called statements to the clergy. So our position is absolutist, but you were going to...
Counsel, part of what we do is try to create a workable rule that people know and can follow. And right now, we have that with Schiffer. Whether you like it or not, it's been working for a long time. And the court in Schiffer, as I read it, created, and so, I mean, we could go stare decisis and decide the case based on that. I know you don't want us to do that. That's one way to do it. Part of what I want to do is get underneath a little bit, and I won't repeat the question, but I'm hoping defense counsel will talk about this too. Schiffer talks about this right in terms of due process. And when you have a statutory right,
the statutory right can't trump a due process constitutional right. So how do you reconcile those things, or do you think it's more akin to the rape shield statute, which deals with more of a compulsory right? How do you get underneath this case in that respect? Because typically, if you're weighing a constitutional concern against a statutory privilege, constitutional concern wins. So I need you to discuss that for me.
I think you've hit on one really important point, which is it's essential that this court identify what is the source of a defendant's right to obtain a pretrial in-camera review. We know that Shifra says due process, they refer to Pennsylvania versus Ritchie. My opponent has said it doesn't really make any difference how you get to point B, how you get to the Shifra procedure, because this court could do it under the state constitution. It could do it as a matter of public policy. Well, I think it's essential that this court identify whether you agree with state versus Shifra's due process analysis, and if so, how do you square that due process analysis with cases such as Weatherford versus Bercy, where the United States Supreme Court, in saying that there is no such thing as a due process right to pretrial discovery, said it was okay for a state not to disclose the names of unfavorable witnesses to a defendant, a criminal defendant, before trial. So I think that when you identify it, that opens up a whole different question in terms of balancing. If it's not based on the federal constitution, is this court going to say that it's based on the state constitution's due process clause?
But part of, I hear what you're saying, part of my problem with that is then we are going to get every case up here because every judge will just decide to fashion whatever relief they think is appropriate in that given case, and then we're reviewing them all piecemeal. There's no workable rule. And frankly, this has been working for some time.
And I beg to differ. When you say it's been working, and I understand you were a trial judge, and in your experience, it probably you felt that it was working. But from what I see happening in the criminal justice system, and I think the aftermath of the appeal in Johnson is a good example of what happened, there the Court of Appeals decision stood, and that court said, you have to turn over your records or you can't testify. T.S., the alleged victim, the victim there because her accuser was convicted, said, I'm not turning over the records. I'm not going to let them be reviewed in camera. And what happened? Somebody who was facing major felony exposure for repeated sexual assault of a child got 60 days in jail after pleading guilty to disorderly conduct and fourth-degree sexual assault. And personally, the state does not believe that shows that Shifra is working. Same thing could happen in this case. We've got somebody who's accused of sexually assaulting a 7 or 8-year-old child and stalking the same person years later. And if the complainant in this case continues to say, I'm holding on to my privilege, I'm not waiving my privilege and letting a complete stranger, a judge, look at 20-some years of counseling records. And I totally could understand why you would not do that.
Ms. Moeller, part of this, I'm interested in hearing your view. You started your argument by you didn't say you were quoting Ritchie, but a lot of the language you were using about the confrontation right could have come right from Ritchie. But in that case, as we all know, the United States Supreme Court fashioned the remedy of the in-camera review. So how do you square the state's argument that, well, the people who are accused of crimes don't have the right to confrontation, that right to confrontation does not include the pretrial discovery, which everyone doesn't seem to be much of a dispute about that legally, but at the end of the case, Ritchie, the court, did order the in-camera review, which is basically what courts around our state have been following since Shifra.
Well, first of all, in Ritchie, a plurality of the United States Supreme Court specifically rejected any kind of confrontation-based right to look at the records. Four members of the court said, nope, we're not, we find there is no such right. And when they did find that there was a right to in-camera review, and of course, Ritchie is in a very different posture because it was after the defendant had already been convicted, so it wasn't looking forward the way Shifra and the Shifra line of cases does. It was looking backward to see what the result would have been. But also in Ritchie, and this is, and I know I sound like a broken record, but in Ritchie, the files at issue were investigative files that were owned by the state of Pennsylvania. They were not records to which a witness had a statutorily privileged right to shield from the eyes of anyone. And a lot of the cases the state has cited in both of our briefs, most recently in the reply brief, I cited the case of Kinder, United States versus White, I think. I don't recall if it's called, I think it's Kinder versus White, where federal courts have repeatedly said that the Ritchie line of cases only applies where the files are in the possession of a government agency or have been in the possession.
And I'd like to explore that a little bit. Say the person who's in the posture of the complaining witness seeks counseling and receives a course of counseling for whatever period of time from some place like the Milwaukee County facility in Wauwatosa. Because the government is the repository and the physicians and the counselors that the complaining witness has been working with are government employees, that doesn't do anything in the state's view to change the nature of the privilege or even anything about the privilege, does it?
I don't believe so, although that specific scenario has not come up in any of the cases I've argued. I do know that in one of the cases the Shifra Court relied on, it was KKC, there the records were held in the possession of the Rock County Department of Social Services. So I think, again, that's a little different story because there those records were available to the prosecutor in that case. But I don't, in answer to your question about the Milwaukee County example, I think part of it, of course, would depend on what the person receiving counseling is told about the confidentiality. But generally, I would say no, that it wouldn't be any different, that just because the person was getting a paycheck from the state, that it would still be privileged under 90504.
And you add, and I know Justice Prosser has been raising his hand for the last several minutes.
Oh,
so
sorry.
I'll ask you to talk with him next. But you added just a little bit of a wrinkle, which I think you smoothed out at the end, that no, it would not matter who was paying the counselor, who was paying the physician, whether it was a private practice or a government-run entity, the privilege would be the same.
Mm-hmm. I think the privilege would be the same unless there was some indication, and we don't have that with the Milwaukee County example.
I didn't mean to name Milwaukee County
but
specifically,
any
county, any state-run facility.
Right. Unless the state, the prosecutor, has come across those records in some capacity, then it kicks into the Brady line.
But that would be the same as any other record.
That is correct.
Okay.
Justice Prosser.
The judge who is handling pretrial proceedings is very often the judge who's trying the case.
Correct.
And the judge trying the case has to be concerned about a trial within a trial. The judge trying the case really is not interested in all kinds of surprises. The judge trying the case is not interested in starting a trial and then not having that trial able to go forward. What I don't quite understand is why the state is so concerned about the judge alone in camera being able to review records.
I think because if you're able to put yourself in the position of someone like the complainant in this case, You're talking about the most intimate thoughts and feelings that are being communicated in an atmosphere of trust, and then years after the fact, you're told, you know what, a complete stranger to you is going to be able to look at anything you said to your therapist, even though you were told it was in the strictest confidence. And if you don't allow that to happen, then the person whom you have accused of sexually assaulting and stalking you gets off scot-free. And I think it's hard. I think judges have a belief that because it's only one person who's invading the privacy of a victim, that that's de minimis. And I respectfully disagree. Certainly, it's much more daunting to think that the accuser's attorney would have access to those records. But I think it's also daunting to think that a complete stranger would be able to invade your privacy and to look at, in this case, we're talking about practically 2 decades.
Counselor,
go ahead. I want to follow up on Justice Prosser's question, because I think I disagree with you on your absolutist approach of the privilege. These students may know, and others in the courtroom may know, when we speak of a First Amendment right to free speech, well, that's not absolute. No constitutional right is absolute. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater is often given as the example of a limitation of a First Amendment right. We have in our statutes exceptions to the physician-client privilege, and the definition of physician, of course, is very broad, and it's set forth for all sorts of health care providers, not just an MD. So how can you say it's so absolute? And then there's even a specific provision in 90504, Sub 4 deals with exceptions, and E says there is no privilege for information contained in a report of child abuse or neglect that is provided under 48981 sub 3 in that kind of a case. So there are all sorts of exceptions that have been recognized to this physician-patient privilege. How can you stand there and suggest that it's absolute? And I say that respectfully.
And probably the way I'm using absolute may not be the same way that you're considering it. If one of the statutory exceptions does not apply, then I'm saying it's absolute. It doesn't get balanced against anything else. But if the court finds that, sure, there are exceptions, definitely, like if there's a crime, one spouse is being charged with a crime against another spouse, that becomes non-privileged material.
Okay, you acknowledge there's exceptions. Then again, to follow up on Justice Prosser's question, it seems that you have a real reticence to let this stranger judge see these reports. And yet I think of the experience of a circuit court judge. I mean, do you know the intimacies of life that circuit court judges see every single day, and we entrust them with decisions from taking children away in horrible cases to mentally committing people to sentencing people for life in prison. I just don't have the same kind of reticence of putting my trust and confidence in a judge's in-camera inspection. Can you respond to that?
I see. My light has gone on. May I answer?
Yes, please answer the question. Thank you.
I'm not saying necessarily that I have the reticence, but that I can completely sympathize with why certain victims have that reticence. And I have to add that there are cases in which we appeal a judge's ruling, and then the judge who looked at the records isn't the only one who is privy to those records. This court's held that the appellate court can look at them, which then means an additional 3 members, law clerks who are working for it. So when you talk about one-on-one, that often isn't the end of the line. Thank you.
Thank you. I want you to answer this question. Namely, what if we agreed with you, what's the retroactive effect, if any, what happens to all the cases that were tried under Schiffer? Can they be opened up again?
I think if they were dismissed before jeopardy had attached and the statute of limitations had not run, they probably could be reopened.
So this has a potential retroactive effect. Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Robert Hennick, and I represent Patrick Lynch on this appeal. I apologize at the beginning, I'm getting over a cold. If I start coughing, I will try to avoid the microphone as much as possible. For the last more than 20 years, the courts of this state have successfully balanced the rights of the defendant to a fair trial, to confrontation, to compulsory process, and the related interest of society in the truth-seeking function of the trial against the witness and the witness's right, statutory or judge-made, to privacy and particular privileged materials. The genius of the Schiffer-Green standard is that by applying that standard, both rights are protected. Both rights.
Counselor, the state doesn't have this information you're seeking either, right?
Correct.
So they're not able to use this to your client's disadvantage.
Actually, if they call the witness to testify, then they certainly are. Because under those circumstances, we're allowing a witness to testify, even though a judge has made a determination that there is evidence that the witness is concealing that is either likely or actually necessary
You're not in that place in this case. What you have is the order that's been appealed, correct?
What we have is a decision by the circuit court that's been upheld and not challenged by the state that there is a reasonable probability that the information is necessary.
Let's just stop a minute because you and I are not communicating.
Okay.
Okay. Does the state have the records you want to see?
No.
Okay. That's the answer to my question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Counsel, then I have a question.
Okay.
You speak of the balancing of interests. And we have cases that come to the Supreme Court, this case, the Johnson case previously, and other cases that make it to the Supreme Court. But I'm concerned about the case in Monroe County or La Crosse County or Winnebago County where you have a live-in boyfriend and you have a child who is being sexually assaulted. And there is pressure on the child or the teen not to allow for the disclosure of that information. Mom doesn't want her to, you know. What's the live-in boyfriend going to do to the family dynamic? And in that instance, the potential of cases of less profile around the state is that the prosecution can be thwarted because pressure is put on the child victim not to consent. And so where is that in your balance?
The
ability to thwart prosecution because of undue influence on an alleged victim.
In a couple of places. First of all, this court recognized in Spies that when a child witness is involved, sometimes the parents are not the proper person to decide whether or not the consent is in the best interest of the child. The state isn't necessarily in the best position. And under those circumstances, it is appropriate for the circuit court judge to assign a guardian ad litem to represent the interest of the child. That minimizes, I understand it doesn't totally take away. However, if there is actual evidence as opposed to just speculation that there is undue influence being applied to a child, there's some kind of intimidation, that is a separate crime.
Sure, that's a separate crime.
So that can be addressed that way.
Everything isn't so highfalutin. That's my concern.
That's true.
It happens day in and day out through trial courts around the state.
Yep.
And your balancing test, in my opinion, said, respond. Show me why I'm wrong. In my opinion, doesn't adequately address the ability to thwart prosecution. That is, an alleged victim can thwart prosecution in many instances. No, you can't have my records, right?
And then we have to discuss what the alternative is, whether the complainant can thwart a defense and the truth-finding function of the trial. Because if we decide instead that the assertion of the right or assertion of the privilege means that we don't even do anything, the witness still testifies while concealing information that the judge has decided is either likely or actually necessary to a fair determination of guilt and innocence, then we have the witness thwarting the truth-seeking function of the trial.
And then you can have a judge. I put a lot of confidence in our circuit court judges, the ability to fashion some kind of remedy to make that balancing test.
And what kind of remedy is the question? The only remedies that I have heard so far are the Schiffer remedy, which keeps the decision in the hands of the witness, or just allowing the witness to testify while concealing evidence that a judge already has decided is likely or actually necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence, or having the witness testify with an instruction in violation of 90513, saying that you should hold this against the witness even though she's or he is testifying. And the response to that is Shifra's response, which is that's really no remedy at all, because the jury is not necessarily going to view the assertion of the privilege as being an attempt to conceal evidence. So those are the three. The fourth is what the state is suggesting here, which is overriding the witness's privilege. Now, if that's necessary, you know, if the only options are either allowing the witness to testify without disclosing or forcing the witness to disclose, then obviously we favor forcing the witness to disclose. But the...
To disclose for an in-camera inspection.
Yes. And if the judge finds that there is information in the records that are necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence, then forcing disclosure of that to the defense. That's the only way that the defendant's right to present a defense, to compulsory process, and to confront the witnesses against him, that's the only way that that can be protected under those circumstances. Merely saying that somebody can testify and conceal evidence, I think as Justice Prosser pointed out in his concurrence in the Johnson v. Rogers Memorial Hospital case, that if you have a question of false accusations of sexual assault, it is against public policy to allow a witness to conceal information that is necessary for a fair determination of that. So I think, you know, when we assess these things, I understand that this is a very complex issue. My suggestion is that Shipra properly balances the interests at stake. The additional concerns on a case-by-case basis where there is intimidation or, for instance, the other thing that was pointed out is possible collusion. You know, collusion, of course, if there's evidence of collusion, then the defendant, in fact, has access to that information, and there's no reason to go through the whole Schiffer analysis anyway.
Counselor, for what period of time are you seeking these records? My understanding is you already have all of them that were used at the trial of her father.
Right.
You also have all of the records that were then in the possession of the district attorney, even though not used at the time of trial. So tell me what dates are they for the records you are asking for that you don't have?
As I recall, it's from 1990 through whatever the date of the motion.
But you have the 1990 records. Those were used at the trial.
Keep in mind that we have the records that were released or were given to the prosecution. What the judge did in this case is we don't know everybody that she spoke with, that she was counseled by. And one of the parts of the order is that the complainant is to identify who she received counseling from. And if
what right in a criminal trial is there to depose the victim? Where does that come from?
There is no right to depose a witness or victim. We're not asking for that.
How is she derelict if she doesn't tell you all the people or identify through the state all the people she's seen in counseling?
Okay. I think where the court is confused is the whole issue of, you know, SHFRA and timing. Now, I'd like to address this.
I'm not concerned about timing. I'm really concerned. Well, I was concerned about timing of the records because I thought you were going to tell me sometime after the prosecution of the father until sometime at the end of the line, but that's not where you chose to go. So my question is really not about timing. I'm concerned, frankly, about setting up a right to pretrial discovery in a criminal case. I don't find it in any U.S. Supreme Court case, and I think you can slip in there bit by bit by bit. And my views are clear about what I think about SHFRA. I wrote about him in Johnson. I'm sure you're well aware that I don't favor that decision, okay? But I'm trying to figure out what else is out there. And one of the things you just told me is you don't know all the people that she's seen in counseling because she hasn't told you that. My question to you is, where do you have a right to ask her for that information? You're missing me on the foundational things.
Okay, the right to confrontation, the right to compulsory process. Davis v. Alaska, we have the right to overcome a privilege
right
when
compulsory
necessary.
Compulsory process is to make a witness appear. Okay, you can make her appear at trial.
Yes.
Okay, no problem, but that's not what you're talking about here.
Well, actually, Your Honor, we are. And I think this is where the confusion is when we refer to a pretrial right of discovery. We're not talking about a pretrial right of discovery. Here, Justice Ziegler asked what the source of the right is. The source of the right is the due process right to present a defense, the right to compulsory process, and the right to confront the witnesses
where
against you. You can do that.
Pre-trial discovery fit in with the right to present a defense, aside from Brady, okay? So we don't need to talk about Brady evidence. I'm back to being concerned about where do you have the right to have her tell you before trial every counselor she ever saw.
Okay. And my point
that
is,
question without
yes,
going
my point
to another.
Is that there is no that you're confusing the right to get that information with a right to pretrial discovery. The right to get that information is the sources I just gave. That the state does not really dispute that I would have the right to get that at trial.
Right, that's correct. And I'm concerned about pretrial, clearly.
Yes.
And you're telling me what you're concerned about is you don't know this information. Pretrial. Why isn't that discovery if you want it pretrial? The right to compel a witness is constitutional. You can bring her into trial and you can ask her whatever questions you want to ask her. That's not what we're looking at here. We are looking at getting information without subpoenaing the victim in. But yet I hear you say, well, I don't know everybody she's seen as a counselor, so how can I prepare?
What we are talking about is a process that the rights, the underlying rights, may be based on something you can do the first day of trial. But this court has the power, and I believe public policy supports it, and individual judges have the power under 906.11 to move that process ahead, as it was discussed earlier, in limine motions. Those issues are dealing with trial issues, but prior to trial. The discovery, in this case, it's not really discovery. It is getting information and avoiding the hassle to juries and to witnesses and to the court process by putting something off till the day of trial when the right is to get the information. The timing is a non-constitutional issue that is based on public policy and doing what is best to keep the process going.
I understand your argument. You and I are just talking past each other, so I'll let my colleagues have a shot at questions.
Can I go back at my question that I was just discussing with other counsel, and you sort of started hitting on it here. When you have a due process right, constitutional right, and then you have a statute that creates or a rule that creates a privilege, mm-hmm. that privilege can't undermine or thwart your constitutional right. So
generally,
The balance, with certain exceptions, but due process, right?
Yes.
Let's just stick with that. So the balancing that was done in SHPRA was that, okay, you have a due process right to information that meets the certain standards, and as I see it, Green tailored that in and made it, in my view, tougher for the defense to show a materiality requirement. But in any event, the court still had to determine if the Green test was met, then the court conducts an in-camera review. What do you think of the balancing being that if the victim doesn't want to turn over her records, there's authority in the statute 146.82.284 to then have a valid court order for those records, and the court review those records, and then if the court determines that there's something in the records that would meet the Green test, right? Mm-hmm. Then you cross the bridge of, okay, either these records are produced or the victim can't testify. What do you think of that as a balancing between the privilege and the due process right that underlies SHPRA?
Well, I agree with the state that even the disclosing, the very limited disclosure for in-camera review is a breach of the privilege, and therefore you have to have a proper showing in order to justify that.
Well, you have to meet the Green standard.
Yes, you
have
to meet the...
Which isn't just, I'd like to see him, can you turn him over, please?
Of course not.
It's stricter than that as I read it.
Of course not. And whether this court, upon an assertion of privilege and saying, I'm not going to consent, whether this court says, well, then you can't testify, or we're going to force you to turn it over, as I indicated in the brief, we don't really have a dog in that fight because the defense rights are protected under either one. I think saying, though, that there is a conflict between the defendant's right to present a defense and the witness's privilege is not really accurate, because as long as SHPRA's exclusionary remedy applies, there is no conflict there, because if the witness isn't testifying, then the defendant's rights are protected. So there would be
the might state could try its case without the victim.
Exactly, but it is there are, and yes, there are certain circumstances where SHPRA would apply. Different than here, where it's not that the defendant is seeking to undermine a state witness's testimony, but instead is seeking positive evidence.
But there's no constitutional right that lies behind the privilege, right? It's just
I would agree
with that, rule.
Yes.
And so that's how I get into my, how do you weigh that when you have a constitutional due process right versus a privilege that's created by rule or statute.
I totally agree. Under Davis v. Alaska, that balancing has to come out in favor of the defendant's right to present a defense when the information is necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence.
You were discussing the Green case in this exchange, and I think had agreement that the Green case standard applies in both the preliminary showing in order to get in camera, the may be necessary is what I'm talking
yes.
about. And also then that's the same standard, if once there is an in camera, to decide with regard to the balancing and whether the information shall be disclosed beyond the in-camera. But the Green Court also said, although there may be the same test, the preliminary showing is less stringent. Isn't that correct?
Exactly. The preliminary showing merely requires a reasonable likelihood that the records will contain information necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence. Once you actually have the records, then you aren't applying this reasonable likely standard. You assess the records as they exist against the other information that the judge has about the case, what the defense is in the case, to determine whether or not there is, in fact, evidence in those records that are necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence.
The defendant has some of the alleged victim's medical records from a previous proceeding.
Correct.
And that would be able to be used at trial, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Well, what I'm really getting at is because you have those records, this is not your normal Shifra case. Couldn't there be some instructions devised that would protect the defendant by advising the jury that the defendant has failed or the victim has failed to disclose certain medical records?
Well, I believe that would violate 905.13, where the parties in the court are not allowed to comment on the exercise of a privilege except the right to be free from self-incrimination in a criminal case, or in a civil case, sorry. So I think it would violate that. Also, as the court in Shifra noted, that there would still be the problem that an instruction would not really encompass everything. That, you know, yes, you can get an instruction that, you know, these wouldn't be helpful to the prosecution. What does that really mean, though? There are different circumstances where, let's just look specifically in this case. There were two main grounds that the circuit court held that the Shifra-Green standard was met. The first is the whole idea of PTSD and information that people who suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome often have problems with remembering correctly, with relating correctly what actually has happened to them. And we have a doctor who is able to testify about that. She could testify to generally the idea that PTSD victims have this problem. But the cross-examination then would be, well, yeah, but you didn't examine the complainant here personally. You didn't, you know, look through any records other than records from, you know, 1992. You know, you don't know what this particular person, you know, has gone through. How can you say that she suffers from these particular things? Same thing with the issue
of... Could you ask the victim, when the victim is on the stand, the alleged victim, have you ever been diagnosed with PTSD?
Certainly. But again, context matters. This court, when you talk about post-conviction motions, you have to do the who, what, when, where, why, and how. And in Davis v. Alaska, the court noted that it's not enough just to say, or just to be able to present evidence that, or to claim that the person is biased. You have to be able to show how and why, the evidence supporting that. And without the evidence from 1992 to 2007, how is the jury going to look at any claim that the witness is suffering from PTSD and therefore has problems remembering if we don't have that context to bring things up to date, to actually to fill out the expert's testimony? We just have an expert saying, that's it.
When I look at your balance, should I take into account that There are allegations that he has stalked the same victim, apparently when she was 16 years of age and into the future. Should I consider that at all in the balance?
I think that it is part of the balance in determining whether or not the information you're seeking is likely in the records and possibly necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence. Also keeping in mind the exact allegation.
That's one side of the balance. Doesn't she have any interest on the other side? I thought I may be misunderstood. I thought there was a balance of privacy interest with his ability to present a defense, and
yes.
So you're concerned about the effect of the decision on her. And I guess my question was, when I'm looking at that balance, should I be concerned that there's an allegation that he's been stalking her many years later?
Yes, taking into account the actual allegations of stalking, which is that he was at a grocery store 5 to 7 times over a 7-month period where she was working.
Well, and also at a bank on repeated occasions.
Yeah, and at a bank where she was working and he had an account.
Counsel, can I talk to you just briefly about why it's an adequate remedy to have the victim precluded from testifying? Why is that so satisfactory if we're talking about a due process right? In theory, the state could still try its case. How is that satisfactory to a person who has a due process right and sits there at trial?
Because the due process right is not a right to stop the prosecution. The due process right is to make the truth-seeking function of the trial work. And in this particular case, what the materiality of the evidence is that it would undermine the allegations of this particular witness. Now, there will be other cases where there are eyewitnesses where, attacking the credibility of a particular witness is not going to make a whole lot of difference. It's not going to prevent the case from going forward, and it's not going to further the defense. But in this case, the state's entire case is based on this witness, and a witness who, for all we know now, wants to conceal information that a judge already has decided reasonably likely will contain information necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence.
You know, this argument, it makes me think about when you have expert testimony in a sexual assault case and you have experts evaluate and comment on, at least to some degree, a victim and the report and whatnot. Does this case, in your view, impact any of those cases?
I do not believe so, because there is a difference between the intrusiveness of actually requiring, as Justice Rogensack was referring to, a deposition of a witness. There's no right to that. We have a right to the information that already exists that's material to the defense. I don't think we have a right to come in and depose a witness and have them provide new information other than through cross-examination at trial. But where the evidence previously existed and it's necessary to present a defense, then I believe that we do have the right to that.
Mr. Hennick, I'd like to have you complete your response to Justice Prosser. As I understand it, Justice Prosser was saying, well, you can get the witness on the stand and ask the witness questions. And what's the matter with that? You can say, have you been seeing a psychologist, psychiatrist, school guidance counselor, whatever you want to ask her.
Yes, I believe I was going into the second, the two different issues that the circuit court granted in-camera review for. The first was the PTSD. The second was the failure to report the allegations. And we can assume, perhaps not with 100% accuracy, but we can assume perhaps that because no counselor reported to the state any allegations that the complainant made against Mr. Lynch, that they didn't do that, or that she didn't make any allegations. However, that isn't the only point of this. For instance, if you say, well, you never reported it, cross-examine the witness, you say, you never reported it, that you never asked me.
You're bound by
That answers it, but it doesn't, it may not be providing the whole thing. There's a difference between not asking somebody in counseling whether or not they were sexually assaulted by Joe, or whether or not what the questions were is, you know, did anybody else sexually assault you? And if the answer is no, that's different than just not being asked in the first place. A third possibility is counseling generally is going into what problems are you having? Why are you having them? What's the basis for this? If the person, I see my light is on. May I finish the,
yes, please.
Thank you. If the response is, well, there's this problem, and there's this problem, and there's this problem, and this problem, and you go through a bunch of problems, and none of the problems is, I was sexually assaulted by this person, then that's even more probative of the fact that it didn't happen. So that's part of the reason why we need to go into these materials, or the judge needs to go into these materials to determine whether or not they, in fact, are reasonably necessary to a determination of guilt or innocence. Thank you very much.
You're bound by the witness's response.
Yes, yes, without having the evidence, the context again.
And you can't challenge that
response.
And unless you have a perjury, but that's a very rare occasion.
Exactly, now, and the witness is able to conceal that evidence absent the court's involvement and requiring the review.
Are you familiar with Professor Fishman's article in the Oregon Law Review on defense access to prosecution witnesses' records?
I'm sorry, I have not read that.
Well, it's a very interesting article and has no... different courts in the different states have taken different views because this is so difficult an issue to balance or decide the rights of the defendant and the privileges of the witness. So I wanted to talk to you about the arguments of this professor.
I apologize. I have not read that. I read a ton of things. There are a ton of Schiffer cases. There are a ton of Ritchie cases. And
Ritchie was a plurality opinion.
The issue dealing with confrontation and whether there is a pretrial right to confrontation was a plurality decision. Justice Blackmun disagreed with that. The other justices were split on other issues. But the due process issue and the entitlement to a in-camera review and going through that, that actually was a majority.
Didn't decide whether this fell under the Sixth Amendment compel witnesses.
Correct. They did not decide one way or the other. The plurality opined on it, but the rest of the court did not.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Please, the court. I'd briefly like to address Justice Ziegler's question regarding balancing when you have a constitutional right on one side versus a statutory right, here a privilege under 90504 on the other, and the suggestion that the constitutional right is always going to come out ahead. I don't think that this Court's jurisprudence actually bears that out. I think most of the time that's true, but if you look at cases like State versus Fisher, it's one of the cases cited in our brief, where this court found that Fisher did have a constitutional right to present evidence that his preliminary breath test was a certain amount, because if his expert had been able to rely on that, he would have been able to show that it was more likely he was below a prohibited VAC at the time he was stopped for drunk driving. The court went...
Was that a due process issue?
I believe it was due process right to present a defense. I believe that's correct. That this court went on and said, but there we have a compelling state interest, and of course the state doesn't have specific constitutional rights, but it was a state interest in keeping drunk drivers off the road, and by making preliminary breath test results inadmissible, it would remove any disincentive for drivers to refuse to give their consent. So that's an example of where the court has found the existence of a right, but then goes on to balance that right against other competing interests. And I think the Pulizzano case using the rape shield statute was another one. And I cited that case also in the state's brief, because in Pulizzano, even though under the facts there, this court went on and said that Ms. Pulizzano did have the right to put on evidence that normally would have been inadmissible under the rape shield statute, because it went to the source of the child victim's knowledge, it was imperative that she have it. But this court made it clear that that was not an automatic ruling, that in every case there had to be a two-part inquiry. First, was there a constitutional right at stake? And second, should that constitutional right predominate over any other interests the state might suggest?
I was just, are you asking us then to add another element to Green?
I'm not asking another element to Green. In our brief, basically what I've said in argument two is that if this court adheres to Shifra's due process analysis, then when it finds that when the circuit court finds that a defendant has satisfied Shifra Green, then you ask the second part of the test. On a case-by-case basis, does the defendant's right to obtain that information, possibly anyway, via in-camera review, predominate, or are there compelling interests in this case to say, no, you don't get that here? And I think that is what happened in the Johnson case. Two members of this court indicated that they would find there are situations where that can happen. And I think using the factors that I've identified, the most important being what kind of information that is non-privileged supports the defendant's defense, goes into that balance. And I think it's important to recognize this is not the same as the Shifra Green question of whether evidence is cumulative. To me, cumulative means you get the same information, but you get it from a different source. In other words,
also,
without...
I'm going to... Did she answer your question
you.
Yet? I don't want to interrupt her.
Okay.
But I want to get back to 146. I am thrilled that we have two talented veteran appellate counsel here today, but don't be confused by my compliments, because I disagree with you on something that you suggested in your earlier responses. I come with the belief that a lot of weight and responsibility is placed on our trial court judges. In your prior response, you have dealt with them as a third-party stranger who shouldn't have this information. I have two questions that arise out of 146, that is, 146.82. Number one, the statute specifically says there are instances when you can get this information, these records, these confidential, we're talking about confidential records now, of healthcare providers, without the consent of the patient. You can get them under 146.82 sub 2.1 if there's an accounting firm that's doing an audit. You can get it to the auditors and the accountant's secretaries and the auditor's staffers. Why isn't a trial court judge just as responsible as they are? You can get it if there is an entity that's doing an accreditation process. So I guess I ask, is this always so sacrosanct that a trial court judge isn't allowed to get the information and make a balancing test? Second question out of 142 is, 142.2 sub 4 says without the consent of the patient, you can get it, and it was referenced by Justice Ziegler earlier, under a lawful order of a court of record. Why shouldn't that answer the question? Those two things emanating from 142.82.
May I answer because my red light has...
Yes, please.
Number one, I am not criticizing judges, circuit court judges, from looking at something like this. But I think that if Your Honor is suggesting that this system works well because judges know what they should or should not be disclosing, I disagree with that. If you look even at the Johnson case, we had five members of this court participating. They disagreed, 3-2, on whether the showing had even been made.
I heard your earlier comments going to the idea that this information shouldn't be, it's so intimate, it shouldn't be placed in the hands of a third party, even a circuit court judge.
And I'm saying that from the perspective of how do you understand why a complainant would say no.
In the interest of time, let's go to sub 4, under a lawful court order. Even if there is no consent of the patient, it shall be disclosed under a lawful court order.
And my answer is, yes, if you reject our argument, the first part of our brief under the due process analysis, and you adhere to SHFRA, then yes, I think 146.82 says lawful order of the court, and this court could lawfully order the custodian to present those records without the privilege holder's consent. I have to say that it puts the state in an uncomfortable position. It's kind of a moral paradox that we're arguing on the one hand that there's this that no due process right exists, but then if we lose, we want to get that. But on balance, we feel that the rights of the public to be prevented, to be protected, rather, from people who are sexual assailants triumphs. Thank you.
Well, thank you both for very, very good arguments. Very interesting and really hard questions. We are going to take a recess now until, well, actually in public for the day. The rest of our work is going to be done. 1:30 we'll meet in closed conference. And we'll take time now to have the students get assembled, I think, for a photograph. And then Justice Ann Walsh Bradley will be out to speak with the students as well. So thank you all very much.